Welcome back, everyone. Or perhaps we should say bonjour, bonsoir, to another episode of Cinema d'Amore. I don't know what the French translation of Cinema d'Amore would be.
Probably Cinema d'Amore.
I mean, probably. French, Italian, Spanish, they're pretty close. This is research we could have done ahead of time, but we didn't, so. I'm your host, Chuck Phillips, joined by...
I am your co-host, Justin, not in charge of research.
One day we'll be big enough that we'll have someone that we can say, ugh, damn it, Kevin, you were supposed to look that up.
It's specifically open to people named Kevin.
Yeah, if your name's not Kevin, don't even apply. Setting that standard early.
So, your theme that you picked for this month is France. Explain.
Yeah. France. It's the only explanation you need.
Like, is it the culture that pulls you towards it, or like you have seen plenty of French films and they're always very good, so you just wanted to be very specific with them this time?
It's just going specific with French, just because it's. I'm trying to think. I don't think we've ever done any French films. We've done like French productions. Like I know, like Possession was like a French co-production,
right?
So we've kind of gotten close, you know, to some of those types of films, but I don't know why it's a country that makes a lot of films that I love. I'd say maybe after like American films, and maybe like I'd probably put French and Japanese films on like the same level of how much I enjoy them. And then from there, it kind of goes to everything else, like, German or Italian films or something. Like French and Japanese are the top two that I think of. And I don't know, we just never got around to any particular films. And there's plenty. Like I said, when I even brought it up to you, I didn't know which way to go. You could go, you know, basically French New Wave, which I won't say any of our films, but we basically avoided that. So that's still just something we can have down the line. But there's a lot of good directors that we didn't even do, like Jacques Tati. I love all of his films, the Hulot series, Jean Cocteau. I love all his, he gets more into the surreal things with like Beauty and the Beast and the Orphic trilogy. There's a lot of stuff that we're not even going to get into, but I think
I'm a huge Melville fan. And
yeah. And I enjoy, you showed me, that was the first time I'd ever seen any of his films, was when you showed me Le Samurai and Le Cercle Rouge, which I think are both fantastic films.
Right, Godard of the French New Wave. I feel like we spoke about him before, where he's still making movies, but after like 1981 or so, he just falls off the face of the earth.
Haven't seen any of those in a while, there's a lot of those, you know, Francois Truffaut. You know, another big hitter of that time. But, you know, I guess to one thing to start off with, some interesting facts that I learned.
Please,
I guess,
start with interesting facts. Let's pull everybody into the conversation.
Yeah, let's really bring them in. You know, we'll get some interesting things about French cinema before we discuss it.
It is a little hard to be interesting with literal crickets with you, Chuck.
Yeah, it makes everything I say
makes it sound boring.
Sound like no one wants to listen at all. One of the things I read was that French cinema is the second largest producers of films in the world after America, which I don't know that I was surprised by that, but I guess I just never thought about how much they crank films out over there. They said in 2015. They had a record-setting 300 films produced, which I guess was the most that they've ever had produced. They're a lot further along than most of their countries, and they also the big production companies of France did a poll a few years ago, I guess, where they took polls in like multiple countries around the world of like, what's your favorite place that, you know, to see films from, and they said America was number one, but France was consistently everyone's like second choice. And they said out of like everyone they polled, like most of the people, they weren't French, they had no connection to France whatsoever. They just were like, yeah, I don't know, I just love French films. for whatever reason, something about their films just like touches people in a very specific way. I feel like the same way. I feel a particular connection when I watch Japanese films. Like I said, that's why I consider those, you know, maybe number one and two, or
even now South Korea is pretty much knocking it out of the park with everything.
Yeah. Somebody had a, you bring that up. I saw, I don't remember if it was BFI or it might've just been a different thing that they were bringing up, South Korean films, and it was like, here's a top 20 list of films for you to see, and 13 out of the 20 were either from Bong Joon-ho, Park Chan-wook, or Kim Ji-woon. It was just those three directors that I'm like, I mean, there's other directors in South Korea, but those three are particularly strong with the quality that they produce.
I honestly think the French films are the foreign films that I started watching first and the most, mostly French New Wave, just by chance, because like that was like this huge boom of essentially where all independent filmmaking goes back to France in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, and it becomes this like, you know, all you need is a camera and we can go from there, we can make up a story, we'll shoot guerrilla style, we'll be out on the streets. We won't have permits. We'll just do what we want. And then you have like, because a lot of these guys, they were reviewing films. They were all critics, and I feel like it was Godard. And the translation's not great, but he essentially said something that translates into the best way to critique a film is to make a better film. So instead of saying, "Hey, I hated this film," like you get your ass out there and you try to make something.
Yeah, that's. I mean, that really is one of the few times that I can think of that ever really happening, of somebody looking at something and saying, you know, basically giving their opinion and then actually like putting their money where their mouth is and saying, you know, I think I can make a movie. And they did. They, you know, all those guys went out and made their own films to various degrees of success, obviously. And again, like we said, Even if people aren't necessarily paying attention to his films anymore, or he's like more underground, Godard is still making films, you know, 50 years later. So
I think he was at Cannes or something. Like one of his films opened there a couple years ago.
Yeah, so he's still out there. You know, he's not stopping. He's gonna.
They keep inviting him to stuff and giving him awards that he will not accept.
Yeah, in just the hopes that he'll show up.
Well, he's like, I guess, the Sex Pistols of filmmakers, because he just gives them the finger, like, I don't need any of these awards.
It's probably one of those things. They probably enjoy that just as much. Like, oh, we got a response from him. He said we suck. They're just happy that he won't even answer. Yeah.
He won't even answer our calls.
It's the worst part if he won't even talk to you, but
he's up there now. I'm pretty sure he's in his 90s, so. And I feel like all the other filmmakers from France in that time, like, they all died very early. Truffaut died early. Yeah. Demi died early. Yeah, it feels like once the career kind of really picks up, they're gone because they died. And then
Godard still. Melville died in like 79, I think. 79 or 80. Like, yeah, all those guys are, yeah, their careers were cut short for whatever reason. Not even like, it's a weird thing. Like when people die super young in something like that, it's almost always like, oh, it must have been drugs, but they're all like cancer or heart attack. Like it was all like natural causes.
You know, the French, they're probably just smoking like crazy. Probably
just all the wine and cigarettes.
Yeah, that's exactly what killed them. The baguettes.
But you know, to start off, we're going to do everything chronologically, which I think is a pretty good way when you approach, you know, a country as an idea. Best to just start from the beginning and work your way forward. We're starting with Henri Georges Clouseau's The Wages of Fear, which, you know, that's a good way to start in that we brought up the French New Wave and, you know, when they started around the late 50s, early 60s. This is from, I want to say, 53. I believe, was the release date on this one. And it's not an early film. I think it's one of his middle films, but they largely attribute everything. I kind of kept reading, I couldn't find like a good translation of exactly what was said, but a lot of people like largely say that his career ended from two things, which was his wife, who stars in this film and a few of his other films, died years after. And that a lot of the critics of the French New Wave hated his films, although a lot of the translations that I tried to find that were hard to like get a good accurate, you know, translation of what was said wasn't specifically that they hated his films or hated him as a director, but just they kind of hated all traditional French films. Like they hated the whole system of making films, kind of like how you said they wanted the idea of, you know, anybody could be a filmmaker, not just people selected out of the system. And he said that largely like depressed him and made him feel bad about his movies. Like he took their criticism to heart and was like, maybe I'm not a good director. I don't know. Maybe my films aren't good. So
I think I've only seen two of his movies. So, and they're both good, but they're his most popular too. So yeah. I mean, he's garnished some remakes out of this. I've seen the remake of this that William Friedkin did, Sorcerer. And I think I own it, but I never watched Diabolique's. Maybe I don't own it. The remake.
Yeah, that years ago.
Years ago I found out they filmed it in my apartment in Pennsylvania. Kathy Bates was there or something.
Yeah. I've never seen the remake, but
I didn't either.
Watching the original, and then I read who is in the cast, and they were like, Kathy Bates is the detective, and I'm like, she's the detective, the goofy guy that like doesn't even do anything in the movie? Like that's the Kathy Bates part in the remake. I'm like, okay, whatever. But I haven't seen the remake of this film. I keep meaning to get around to it because I like William Friedkin as a director. I like everything else I've seen.
Once you have like unruly characters trying to transport nitroglycerin in a rickety truck, I mean, you've got a good film.
Sold, yeah. But yeah, that is the plot of this film. It's a very good way that they set this up. Whereas I feel like a lot of directors would want to maybe just get straight to the serious, you know, high suspense moments. And he really lets it sit with you just getting to see these characters living down in South America from different countries. There's Germans, Italians, British, even Americans, French. They're all just kind of down there and they just have nowhere to go. They're all basically trapped. They got there somehow, some way with whatever money they had. And now, you know, the prices have all gone up. They don't have any money because they can't get work. So they're kind of just trapped there in this country that doesn't want them there. They don't really want to be in this country.
A lot of them are illegal, so they can't even get work.
They have,
get out of there.
Yeah, they have nowhere to go. They get threatened frequently, I guess, from the local tavern owner that he'll call immigration, but it kind of sounds like they wouldn't even really care that much if they called. It's like, oh, what are they going to do? Ship me back to my home country? Like, whatever.
Yeah, I really like how slow this movie starts off, where it literally gets you to, like, live in the environment for a bit. So you never really know who exactly is going to be the protagonist.
Yeah.
They follow, like, a few people around to the point that I guess what would become the four main people, one is introduced way later than the rest of them. Well, actually, two are introduced pretty late, and one barely has any screen time. And then the other one, like, one of the people that they choose to drive and mysteriously doesn't show up, that guy seems like he could very easily have been one of the people driving the truck for how much time you've been with him already.
Yeah, he gets shown a lot in the beginning, yeah. It's a good mix of like different characters that they have going on there. Our leading man is very much I don't know. The only thing I kept saying was I guess he's the French Humphrey Bogart because he looks very much like Humphrey Bogart, and I feel like if this movie was made in America, it gives me like strong Treasure of the Sierra Madre vibes. Like just his character in general, it's kind of like not a good guy, kind of out of control, but he's kind of like he's also kind of just trapped somewhere that he's just begging for work anywhere.
I like how he's a seducer but also is like these women.
Yeah.
He literally like pushes her in the mud and like berates her for being into him, which he really shouldn't be because he's poor. He has nothing to his name except clean clothes every once in a while.
Yeah, he gets his buddy Luigi, you know, Mario and Luigi.
Yeah, Mario and Luigi.
They just happen to be roommates. You know, they're practically brothers. Which is, I don't know why that does just make me laugh every time I watch this movie. And I'm like, oh, I forgot the two friends are Mario and Luigi. But yeah,
that's before, and I doubt it was even inspired by the video game characters.
Probably not. I'm sure it was a random weird coincidence.
Hey, it's like It's a Wonderful Life with Bert and Ernie.
Yeah,
but that was I'm pretty sure Bert and Ernie were named after It's a Wonderful Life.
I think so. Yeah, the way they go about it at the beginning, you know, we get our leading man, and like you said, he's not even necessarily like right off the bat, he's not like that good of a guy. He gets the most screen time, so I guess you can quickly tell he's supposed to be kind of the main character, Mario. But yeah, he's just kind of lazy. He just kind of sits around most of the time. But then yeah, when he meets Joe, who shows up, and like suddenly he sees a guy that gets respect from people, and it's like a little kid that just, I don't know. I don't think he ever really brings up his parents or anything, but definitely feels like maybe he didn't have a father, and he's just like grasping onto this older guy that gets respect from everyone. And he thinks like, oh, I got to follow this guy around. Like I'll start getting respect from people and my life will change. And you know, we'll do cool things if I hang out with this guy.
Yeah. It's interesting because when Joe shows up, he's broke. He even says later on that he spent his last $50 on a plane ride and he didn't have a visa or anything. I guess I wonder if he's including that $10 that he paid off that border agent that was looking at the visa. Guy was probably like, I don't give a shit, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely gets into town. I enjoy the way he stops in the cab, just kind of down the street. And then the guy's like, give me a dollar. And he's like, I don't think I'm even going to stop here. Like, just tries to play it off like, but clearly he doesn't have the money to even pay this guy to the $1 that he owes him. Then he meets Mario and they say, oh, we'll go down the street to the saloon. And he's like, oh, pull up in the cab. It'll look better when we get there.
I do love too when he get out and there's the bar owner and there's like, pay this guy. Like yeah. He's rich or something. Like it's expected of him.
Yeah. He's just immediately trying to get everyone to pay for things. And it's a good dynamic the way they start the early parts of the film with Joe, in that, you know, he has a gun, which obviously it doesn't seem like a lot of people have any kind of gun or any kind of real possessions. They're all very poor there. So the fact that he even has a gun means he can kind of push people around because no one's going to stand up to him. And, you know, he kind of just gets that respect from everyone around him. They all kind of back off when he says, you know, turn off the music. The bar owner turns off the music and makes sure no one turns it back on because, you know, he says it annoys him, and he just gets his way.
Turn that back on.
Well, yeah, later on he does, but he keeps making sure to like get his way, and he like kind of gets Mario to kind of fall under his wing, especially when, you know, he's gonna go on a date with his girlfriend, and Joe's like, oh, okay, I guess you don't want to be friends anymore. I guess I'll just go get a haircut by myself.
The girl, I really like that scene in the beginning where she's scrubbing the floor and they're like flirting and she goes over to him and he's like rubbing her head. She's like on all fours and Mario's just rubbing her head, and that other woman that works there like looks through the window and sees it as if it's like the oddest thing ever.
Yeah.
She's like, what the fuck is going on? Like that's her reaction. Also, it also reminds me a little bit of some like Wes Anderson thing where she's stealing the drink and she hides it in the flower or whatever, and she like poorly covers it up. It just totally seemed like something that he would do.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't just hide that blatantly in front of you. I didn't see the French Dispatch yet.
Yeah. We don't know if that's a plot point there. We don't know what kind of stuff's going on in that film. But yeah, they keep kind of showing us everything. We get that, you have that other desperate guy, the Italian, that, you know, is constantly like showing people his visa. He keeps telling people like, oh, I just need to go home. Mm-hmm. I just need to get out of here.
Bernardo.
Like, yeah. If you could just give me a few dollars, like I could go home. Like, he's real desperate. Like I said, the way they like really build up this desperation in the characters in these early scenes, just showing them, and then, you know, we kind of get like a reason for why everybody needs to do this. We hear from the doctor that Luigi, you know, is basically going to die pretty soon because he's been inhaling too much concrete dust that it's just sitting in his lungs. Happens to the best of us. Yeah, so he's going to die pretty soon if he doesn't do something different. So, yeah, that kind of pushes him in the desperation.
If he doesn't do something different,
yeah,
he needs a change in career so he doesn't die.
Yeah, literally anything else. You know, and then Joe and Mario just kind of want the money so they can go back to France and live out their lives. Well, I guess Joe's on the run, so he probably can't go back to France. They need to go to some other South American country or something, maybe, or somewhere in Africa or something to get away from whoever Joe's running from. So I just like, again, I like the pacing of that opening, just the way it really, everything feels like it's covered in sweat and dirt. Like you just really feel that heat and desperation on all these characters. It's, you know, if they just went right into the, hey, we'll give you $2,000, go drive this truck. And then it's like, yeah, but I mean, is $2,000 really that bad? But like now, as you're seeing, like, it's like, oh yeah, they definitely need this money.
Right. This film fits into that theme too, of it just takes place on the hottest day of the year and everybody's miserable. Yeah. 100%. I also really like how they display this whole town as extremely poor. And then you have the military that has like cars and trucks, and they're always driving through puddles of mud and splashing people and whatever those are. They supposed to be vultures or something. I don't know what the birds are. Cranes, yeah, of some sort. They just like violently drive past them. Like, we don't give a shit about you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those, like, they could definitely, I know I read that they cut a lot of the movie out for the original American release. They basically cut out all of the parts that made the Americans seem, you know, uncaring, which is definitely there, that they're,
well, how did they
they're
do just that? There they for were the oil. In a truck? Yeah. We're uncaring. We're just there for the oil.
Yeah.
I do like the comments they make too, where they show off the grave sites and he makes a comment about them being the Americans. And there's like, oh, there's that many Americans. He's like, well, when there's oil, there's going to be Americans, yeah, which is
true.
My entire life, that's a very accurate statement.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, the only reason they're there is for the oil, you know. And then, yeah, that's what drives the entire plot, is that there's a fire at the oil rigs up on the mountain, and the only way to put it out is to blow it up with nitroglycerin.
That imagery is great too. I love how calm the guy is when he's on the phone talking about as it's like blazing fire behind him,
the flames behind him, and then he's got the guy next to him completely wrapped in bandages, and he's like O'Brien gives his regards, and the guy like just looks in the distance. Like,
it reminded me a little bit too of one of your favorite movies, There Will Be Blood.
Yeah,
just like that.
It's 100. It's the exact concern same thing,
of the oil. Well, there's a lot of people that end up dying in that explosion, but I do like the idea of, because of the unions, nobody can take this job because they need to put out these flames, and they can only do it with nitroglycerin, and nobody will let anyone in their union do that because it's too dangerous of a job. So I do kind of like the idea of, like, these people are poor. Let's exploit them and take advantage of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole setup is, you know, these guys don't have families. No one would care if they went missing. Like, we'll just port four of them into trucks and, you know,
make them do the dirty work. The only one that really seems to care is Mario's girlfriend.
Yeah.
She's the only one that is, like, legitimately upset that he signed up for that.
Yeah.
And he just opens his door and knocks her into the mud, which I think is actually really funny, where that moment where they're just driving, this is like they first got in the trucks, so he's taking his time driving through the city, or if you want to, it's not even a city, the little town, and she gets all upset and she runs and she jumps on the truck and she has a conversation with him in the window, and I just love that he's like, get out of here, and he just like opens the door and knocks her on the ground, and I'm thinking, well, he's lucky that she just didn't get run over in that moment, because this truck's like massive. And they also show, too, especially with the taxi, when Joe shows up in the taxi from the airport for the first time. It's driving on this like muddy, poor excuse for a road, and it's so extremely bumpy. So the fact that the plot ends up going into the fact that, you know, nitroglycerin, almost nothing can make it explode. And they're like, yeah, this is the shitty place that everybody already lives, where the roads are just awful. I think that's a really good, and it's a really good way to build the tension early on, when it's more, what I would say, what, the first 40 minutes or so is just understanding the locale and the how these people actually are.
Yeah. Yeah, we get they prove themselves to be good drivers. Well, the four of them, obviously. Joe does something that we don't know what he ever does. We see that guy later on, so it's not like he killed him or something like that. I guess maybe it's just assumed that maybe he like slipped something into his alcohol, or maybe he just got him like so blackout drunk that he passed out and couldn't get up. Yeah. We don't know what Joe did to make,
because he seems so sure that guy's not showing up when he does.
He's he knows he's not going to be there for sure. Which again, that was my
least favorite character, by the way, the one that didn't show up
because he was throwing rocks at a dog.
Yeah, maybe that's what it started.
I kind of figured that was probably why you made him not like him.
You know what? I forgot about that. But yeah, he starts off by throwing rocks at a dog. This isn't a very PETA film. There's rocks thrown at a dog, and there's a tarantula stepped on, and I'm pretty sure it's not a special effect. I'm pretty sure they stomped on a tarantula.
Yeah,
he's like, they're nasty. Like that poor tarantula.
We get a good start. Good start at seeing, you know, a little bit more into these guys' character when they first start loading the trucks up. You see the German Bimba, who seems to be like he starts out as this very tough, stoic character. You know, he doesn't really say very much. We don't see him that often before this, but he seems to be very much like a, you know, just a tough guy. You know, he starts off with telling everyone he'll smash them over the head if they try to interfere with his driving test. And everyone kind of takes him real seriously that he's strong enough to do it. And we see that he starts to get very nervous when you get that first slip of somebody walking up the ramp with one of those cans of nitroglycerin. But Joe, I don't know. I really love his character in this film. I feel like he has the biggest, like, I don't want to say maybe character arc, but he has the biggest range in the film that you get to see from him. Cause that's when you really first start to see, you know, he wants to like kick the tires and the guy's like, what are you doing? He's like, I just want to make sure everything's good. He's like, it's a brand new truck. Get in the truck and start driving. And he's like, hold on, turn all the lights on. I want to see what the lights look like. Like, turn the siren on. And they're like, get in the truck. You need to leave. And he's like, I don't know, man. I just like want to give the truck a once over. Like he just really is like pushing to stall. Like he absolutely seems like he doesn't want to get going, like, for some reason.
He's nervous though too, because there's a part where he can't start the truck, and he's like, "Oh, this thing is junk. It won't start." And Mario's like, "Dude, you forgot."
Yeah, you didn't hit the switch there. when the American comes up and he's like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "Never mind, I figured it out." I
love
fine.
Too when they first start, like, it seems like it's gonna be okay, but after they drove through the town and they're on that like that first bad road, he just drives really slow and he's just like sweating, and the guy that offers him coffee, and he's like, I have to have two hands on the steering wheel.
He's like, how am I supposed to hold it? And Mario's like, with your hand. And he's like, I can't. And he's like, fine, I'll throw it out. And he's like, I hold it to my lips. Like, yeah, he's like, yeah, what he asked him, is it hot out? And Mario's like, yeah, of course it's hot out. It's roasting out. And he's like, I'm freezing. Like, he has to put the sweater on him because he says he's like breaking out in a chill. He blames it on malaria. Too,
yeah, they have two sets of two teams that each drive, and they're supposed to be half hour apart so that they, you know, they don't accidentally blow each other up. Trucks. Yeah. And it's really funny because it seems like they've been driving so slow that by the time that they stop for just a few minutes, the second truck's already like caught up to them.
Yeah. Yeah. He wants to take a break and have sandwiches. And, you know, yeah, Mario keeps going. No, yeah, he's what I think he says. Don't you smell oil? I think the engine's overheating, and he like touches it. Aren't you hungry? He's like it's kind of warm.
We're only 10 miles down the road. What are you talking about? It's not time to eat yet.
Yeah,
we're barely there.
So
I do like the tension with like the tire, and it would go into the mud, but like you weren't sure of like how deep the mud was gonna be, and then coming back out. A lot of good moments like that, or when the one truck passes the other truck, and they're very close to each other. Yeah, there's a lot of good tension in that sort of way.
Yeah, it really is a movie that it kind of has to have that slow pace. Like it's one of the only kind of it's not a car chase movie, but it's definitely like a
it
road.
It would be a good car chase movie though.
It's like a good road driving movie, except all the characters have to drive like under 40 miles an hour for the entire thing. Like they can't
it's
drive
the opposite
fast
of speed. Don't hit a bump or you explode, but speed is you can't go under 55 or you explode.
So yeah, it's good the way I think he does a really good job of really getting a lot of suspense out of these moments where it literally is just them driving as slow as possible. But then he also gives the, you know, he has like the part where they have to stay over 40 miles an hour to get over the ruts in the road because they have to fly over them, which again is another moment with like
Bimbo
Joe
explains that, he's like, if we go too slow, it's going to be too bumpy. We have to go just the perfect amount of speed over all this.
You have to stay over them, which is another moment of Joe where like we see he keeps like letting off the gas every time they start getting up to 40 miles an hour, and you know he's like, oh, I don't know, this truck must be bad, and I guess it's just a terrible truck. Like, probably
like
we should complain to him.
I enjoy the vulnerability and how much kind of seeps through his desperation, because you talked about how everybody in this town is desperate, and I would say for the most part, the protagonists or the four main people that end up being on these vehicles, they seem the least desperate until they're actually in the vehicles and you realize that they're maybe even more desperate or worse than the other people that we've already seen in this town.
Yeah.
And I think the prime example is Joe, because he just takes this, like, he's very nonchalant until he finally gets in that vehicle. It kind of reminds me of something like, I think we were talking about another episode where we were talking about like Death Proof, and when what's his face gets shot. And he just like breaks down.
Yeah, like it just gets too real all of a sudden.
Yeah. So his cool is like instantly gone when he's driving that truck. Even though he's like, yeah, I can drive. I'm a good driver. I do like the short driving lesson that they had with everybody just to make sure that they could drive. Yeah. And it almost felt like it could be like a montage, like a buddy montage of learning to drive. But yeah, and that guy Bernardo that's just like so worried that he just keeps messing up.
Yeah, he's too nervous. Yeah, you really get to see that the character, well, especially I'm surprised they don't have like more people to just leave when the one character, I think he's an American that's there, and he brings up that that like basically it's not worth it. Like, oh yeah, sure, you'll get $2,000, but your nerves will be fried for the rest of your life. He's like, you know, basically like 2 days driving this stuff will feel like 10 years because you'll just be so scared the entire time. I think he says like, it'll turn your hair white and your hands will shake for the rest of your life, 'cause you'll be thinking about that. Like, you know, that's just too intense.
Man, be like, have you ever had to drive a nitroglycerin truck over a mountain to put out a blazing fire? All right, Grandpa.
Yeah, we get it. Yeah, so they keep going. I like that Luigi keeps trying to signal them to help them, but every time he like tries to make a signal, they either like ignore it or it gets, you know. He leaves that like handkerchief in the middle of the road for them to see, but then the local guy picks it up and like, you know, throws it away or something like that, or waves at him. And then they get up to the little like bridge or beginning of a bridge that they have to turn around on, that the first truck drives right through, puts a big hole in it, and they're like, we need to warn them. And the German's like, hey, they had their chance. They should have been in front anyway, so we need to leave. So
Yeah. It's a cold, honest thought.
It is, yeah. He's like, hey, we got to get away from it. We can't be around here. We can't wait around. Well, that
character, too, is talking about being, like, in the salt mines for years. So it doesn't sound like he was tortured or, like, on some sort of, I don't know. He was doing some sort of hard labor work for years against his will. So I think during that World probably War II. That'll make a man cold.
Yeah. That sounds like, I guess, what he was doing during World War II. He describes being in Nazi territory, or that his parents, I guess, got hanged for being. He doesn't necessarily go into details of, like, why exactly his family was killed. Just kind of mentions that he's basically an orphan. He doesn't have any connections to anybody. He's just here.
He would be the blonde hair, blue eyed German that Hitler wanted.
Yeah.
But obviously his family wasn't Nazis. So maybe they were the family. If they were being hanged, they must have been the people that were trying to hide Jews or. But you take it that he comes from. He's desperate like everyone else, but you take it that he is good and he doesn't have that, like, Nazi nationalism to him that is, like, he's not his country. That's why he left.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a good German.
Yeah, we got the.
Wasn't that a book, The Good German?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a movie, too. I think so. Could be.
Sounds right.
It sounds right. Or wait, The Good German. Isn't that the Steven Soderbergh movie? Is that what we're thinking of?
I was thinking of a book that was like a romance book between I thought it was like a Jew and a Nazi.
What am I thinking of? What's the one? What's the Soderbergh one with Tobey Maguire?
There's like The Good Shepherd.
No, there's something different.
The Good German does not sound right, but.
Hold on, we have to resolve this. There's
Good Night, Good Luck.
Yeah. Yeah, The Good German. That was exactly what I was thinking of.
It was called The Good German?
That's the Soderbergh movie with Cate Blanchett and George Clooney and Tobey Maguire. Yeah. That's what we were thinking of.
Well, I'm sorry to confuse you.
I was like, I'm pretty sure I know that I'm thinking of that.
I'm pretty sure I know what I'm thinking of. I love
pretty
that.
Pretty sure I know what I'm thinking of.
I'm going to say that one day and you're like, I'm pretty sure I know what I'm thinking.
Yeah. So that's his character. And then, I don't know. We don't get too much on why Luigi's, there. We don't know necessarily his motivations for why he came to South America.
So he can afford more pairs of pants.
It's definitely what he needs. He needs all those pants. He needs all those clothes. Joe makes mention of, like, who's this gangster on the wall? Is that Luigi's dad or something like that? So it's like, I don't know. Maybe that was more than a joke. Maybe Luigi is from, like, some sort of crime family and he had to run. You know, maybe the rest of his family got killed in some sort of legitimate dispute.
He seemed like mafioso. Like, he honestly did seem like a legit gangster of some sort. Yeah. He reminded me a lot of that guy that was in the latest season of Fargo.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, the big Italian guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, he reminded me of him a lot. Because he was a little bit goofy, but that moment where he came into the bar and everyone was like, oh, shit's going down.
Yeah, it was. I was watching, they had an interview with the assistant director on the Criterion. Again, I'm not going to plug Criterion, but we're talking about a lot of Criterions this month, so
yeah.
We might have to, you know, we might be mentioning that a few times.
I specifically made one of my choices to be non-Criterion because the top three were other Criterions.
Just to break it up, yeah. But, yeah, they had an interview with him, and he brought up that they wanted to hire everyone, you know, to actually be the nationalities that they were from. So, he found, like, an actual Italian actor, you know, he went to find a German actor. He wanted actual French actors for those roles. And they said that, like, that chemistry, like, actually worked really well, because he said their personalities were very much the same. Like, he said the German and the Italian actor would like argue all the time about how they felt like scenes should go. And the, like the Italian actor was like way more laid back. It was like, ah, I think we could just play the scene like this. And the German actor would be like, no, it has to be like, you know, it has to be this. I have to walk through this doorway. I have to do this. They said that like it plays really well in the film when they're together, because they actually legitimately like did act like that in real life. They had those opposing ideas.
Then were they good actors, or were they just good at being themselves?
They might just be good at being themselves.
Honestly, a lot of things are cast well from non-actors just because they're perfect for that role.
Yeah.
You know, I know that they're doing Clerks 3 right now. Like, I kind of felt like that way, where Kevin Smith used his friends that were basically the characters that he wanted.
Yeah.
And you don't really see them in anything else except all these, like, Clerks anything, 2 yeah. and now Clerks 3.
Anything Kevin Smith does, yeah.
I mean, they're not even usually main characters in any of his other stuff. They might pop up for like a moment because he talked them into it again. Yeah. It seems to be his thing, talking them into it again.
But yeah,
I enjoy this movie a lot. I feel like it has, it's not just tense for it's not just all suspense. It really helps, I think. You talk about the slow burn aspect of it. It definitely helps learning and starting to like these characters on a human level before introducing explosives.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always the big thing. Yeah, those, and we kind of, the way the dynamic, again, like I said earlier, seeing the characters of Joe and Mario together, I really enjoy just watching how their dynamic changes throughout the whole film. It slowly becomes, you know, at the beginning, he worships everything Joe does. You know, he's like, you know, he gets him new clothes. He basically just steals them from his friend and is like, hey, this is my buddy Joe. He's got to have new clothes. Like, you know, he does everything for him.
His are dirty. He doesn't have time to wash.
Yeah. He goes out to, he says, oh, I gotta go eat, get some food somewhere. And he's like, oh, you don't eat here? And he's like, and he knows he doesn't have money to afford food here. He's like, no. So he goes and gets Luigi to like cook him pasta, but so that he can spend his money on cigars for him and Joe. And then just the way you finally get to that point where Joe tries to like run away from the job from him. And that's like kind of the point where from that point on, Mario's just like, yeah, whatever, I guess. Oh, I thought you were a real tough guy, you know, kind of like berates him for a lot of the time, the rest of the movie, you know, keeps putting him down like, oh yeah, I thought you were a real, you know, a real guy that I wanted to be like. And now I see you're just an old coward that, you know, couldn't do anything. He's like, oh, I'm sure, kind of says like, oh, I'm sure if you didn't have that gun, like anybody could knock you down.
Which is true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. And I mean, hey, what's the one thing you expect to happen in this movie?
Oh, you mean you're waiting for someone to blow up?
Yeah. You don't know if it's going to be both, but you expect at least one of these trucks are going to blow.
You just don't know when. The moment that it happens, the moment that we do finally get to that moment, though, is like, there's something about that scene that works so perfectly. The way it comes out of nowhere. Like, you know, we see Luigi and Bimba in their truck, and they're having conversations. He's shaving. Bimba's shaving because he's like, hey, if I die, I want to be presentable when I die. You know, that's the last thing my father did before he was hanged. He asked for a shower and a shave, like before he got killed. And the way then it cuts back to Mario and Joe in their truck, and you know, he's just starts rolling a cigarette, and then all the tobacco just blows out, and then there's just a flash, and then you just see smoke, and the truck's just gone.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool way to show that explosion. It has this like subtle but shocking way of doing it, and I believe partially they couldn't do the effect, you know?
Yeah.
And it's this, because it's a close-up of the tobacco being rolled, and it's literally like, so somebody like must have blew it out of his hand for the shot.
Yeah, probably like a fan or something like that they just turned on real quick. Yeah, something blows it.
Because it legitimately doesn't make that much sense for the scene, because the explosion's like like 2 miles away.
Yeah, technically, but the flash would be before the wind in this version. In this way, they have the wind come before the flash.
Yeah, but it's a good moment of like, holy! It brings a lot more realism to what these two people are doing. And then I think my favorite part is when they kind of get up to that moment, how that explosion has caused more chaos for them. It made their journey that much harder for being behind now.
Yeah, when they get to the scene of where the explosion happens and there just isn't a truck anymore, there just isn't anything left. It's just a crater in the ground that now oil's pouring into because it busted open the pipeline, and all the trees are, you know, broken in half from the explosion, and there's nothing left except he finds Bimba's cigarette holder, and he's like, you know, Joe's like, wow, that's the only thing that's left out of this entire truck. Like, everything else is gone.
Don't you feel like it would also be on fire?
Well, like the tree? No, because it's not
like the oil.
Well, no, because remember the oil that would put it out. It's not because nitroglycerin's not a flaming. It's not like gasoline. It doesn't ignite. It just creates the sonic boom. That's why they needed to put the flame out at the top there.
Yeah, and it gets more tense than you would expect it to, I think, in that mud scene too.
Yeah.
Well, the oil scene where they can barely get the truck out.
Yeah.
And
Joe tells him if you stop, you'll never get back out. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he just has to keep going, and he's like, Joe, don't make me run you over. And he's like, I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to run you over. If you don't get out of my way, I'm going to do it. If I stop.
He legit runs Joe over.
Yeah. Which I do love.
You can tell that he doesn't want to do it, but he knows that he can't be stuck that deep into the oil.
That actually, I really love that moment when he's dragging Joe out of the oil, and he's like,
yeah,
he's like, if I hadn't hesitated, then, you know, we wouldn't be stuck. And Joe's like, you hesitated for me? Like he really, it really does touch him that, you know, he actually did, like, he didn't just unthinkingly just like roll over him. Like, he did hesitate for a second before he kept going. Like it really does make him think, like, oh, I'm glad you at least hesitated.
The effect is really wonderful too for his leg, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's the oil that hides it well, but it looks like
it looks like it's like not even attached to his like it's broken and just like
it's not broken detached. It's just it's hanging off like the bone's not there's no the bone is completely separated.
It looks pretty gross when he's pulling him out of the oil there, but yeah, that's there's a lot of good moments like that that are just I think it's good because it doesn't just I think they know that they couldn't keep it tense for like an entire, you know what, it's a 2.5 hour movie, and they don't even start driving the trucks till like almost an hour in. So it's like, to keep that pace up for an hour and a half of just like constantly being tense.
Right. The catalyst doesn't even start until at least 40, 45 minutes into the movie.
Yeah. It's you're almost halfway into the movie before that even starts, but they do a good job of pacing it in that they give you the tension, and then they like pull it off at like just the right moment to kind of make you go like, oh, okay, like we're okay. But then they immediately start driving the trucks again. Okay. They immediately start driving the trucks again, and you're like, oh god, it's tense all over again, because now they're back on the road, and you know they got these bouncing around up there.
Hey, there's even more added tension too, because not only are the bumps there, now it's clear that Joe is dying. And they need to get there to get him like medical help as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So they need to be quick, but they can't be quick. Good writing.
Yeah. 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 That's a perfect moment. Yeah. He can't drive fast. He just has to stay a steady pace. And, you know, he tries to keep Joe awake, tries to tell him to, you know, he asks him about his neighborhood in France, and, you know, they kind of like reminisce. You know, he keeps saying,
do you think that he was making up that street that he remembered? It seemed not legitimate when he was
I kind of took it the same way.
Yeah, that street was there, because then he starts talking about the fence. He's like, there was a fence there. And the guy's like, sure, there was a fence there. And I was like, I don't know.
I think maybe
he never was there, and he just kind of said that to impress Joe early on.
I think that was just a lie. He's probably never actually been to Paris. He's probably never been anywhere like nice. He's probably always lived out in like the country or something like that. And yeah, it definitely felt like that at the end, that he's just trying to comfort Joe when he's saying like, oh, do you remember this street? And he's like, sure. Yeah, I remember that street. Like, yeah, he's just trying to tell him. And then, yeah, he keeps asking about the fence, and he's like, oh, there was nothing behind the fence, Joe. It was just an old lot. Like he doesn't even want to like get into it, and then yeah, it seems like Joe at the end, again, this movie gets dark, especially towards the end there after everyone keeps dying. But yeah, Joe's final words are,
"Gets dark after people gets so dark many people die," and you're dying. Like, "This film is dark."
But yeah, the Joe's final words are, "Oh God, there's nothing," which I feel like is supposed to be taken as like, as he's dying, he like everything's just going black, like one of those, like, "I thought there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel" sort of things. And he's just like, "There's nothing."
It correlates really well with Mario saying there's nothing behind the fence.
Yeah.
He's like, "There's just nothing there." And it feels like he's saying that to cover his ass that he wasn't actually ever there. But yeah, his final words being like, "Oh shit, there's nothing," literally just seems, I don't know, atheist, you know, there's no afterlife.
Yeah, there's nothing. And yeah, he finally gets there just as Joe dies. And
well, what's the most ominous thing that anyone could say as they're dying?
Yeah.
Probably there's nothing.
Yeah, that's when it finally hits Mario, and he gets out of the truck and just starts like stumbling around, and it's like he just wants to see the fire. He wants to see the thing that he was supposed to come and stop, so he keeps walking to it before he finally passes out.
And then yeah, then he gets rewarded, and it seems unfair because he's like collecting the money that Joe would have got too.
Yeah, he gets Joe's share, and they're like, "I'm sure he would have wanted you to have this." And I'm like, "I don't know if he really would have wanted him to have it." They didn't, their relationship didn't necessarily end on good terms, but
oh, he hesitated before.
Yeah, straight he didn't up completely run him over, but yeah, I love the final moments when he calls the. He calls the little town and tells the barkeep, you know, that it basically, you know, everybody else died. And he's like, "I'll be back this afternoon." And basically, like, he's going to get ready to get a plane ticket and fly out of there. And, you know, they turn the music on and everyone starts dancing. And it's just a great back and forth the way they keep cutting back to Joe and, or not Joe, to Mario. And
Mario.
He's like,
they keep cutting back to Joe. Yeah, it's just the
he's
corpse.
He's just dying there. The way they keep cutting back, and like you really do get the sense that this is the first time Mario's been happy in like maybe ever, or at least a very long time, that, you know, he actually sees like maybe there's brightness, like maybe he can finally, you know, he can finally leave this place, and, you know, he can take his girlfriend with him if he wants to, or leave her. We don't know what he's going to do, but you know, he can finally get out of this place and start his life over. And, you know, so he's driving a little recklessly, you know, doesn't really care all that much for the, you know, has the whole road to himself. And yeah, just the way they keep cutting back and forth is just perfect.
See, I didn't take it as joy for him. I took it as like a mental breakdown. I took it more along the lines of he was just, he couldn't comprehend living, and that's why he was being so reckless.
Could be.
It just wasn't important to him anymore because, you know, these people basically fought to make a living and then end up dying over it. And, you know, I guess he sees pointless dying and then is told there's no afterlife, so.
Yeah.
What a fun. Bless you.
Oh, I felt that one coming. But yeah, I guess you could look at it either way, that either he's just delirious with joy, or that he's just, yeah, on a suicidal at this point because he's seen so much and, you know, just can't handle it at this point. But, you know,
or maybe his nerves are a wreck too.
Yeah, it's just that he's just is at completely out of control. And then
I do like, though, that it's him that causes his own death at the end of the movie, instead of like it could have been a like karma, a bad accident or something, you know. Yeah. The truck just got stuck and fell over the hillside. It's literally because he was driving recklessly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great film. And this is something too that back in the day when we were working at Hollywood Video and it was closing down, you were like, hey, have you seen this? No, you should buy it. It was like $2. So that's still the copy I have.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think at that point I had bought the Criterion. Cause I think it was getting ready to maybe go out of print at that time. Cause I know a bunch of his were, I bought Le Diabolique when it was going out of print, and his other two movies from the Criterion, Le Corbeau and Quai de Sofrevres. I don't know. That one's a harder one to say. But they were like all going out of print, and I had bought that one, and I was like, yeah, that movie is amazing. And I do like his follow up, Le Diabolique. I was going back and forth between the two of them. I was trying to think of which one. I feel like I like Wages of Fear better, but I do feel like Le Diabolique is a very good movie. It's a very, very effective horror film. Gets into a different type of suspense.
And where are we going next week?
We're going to more France. Now we're going.
We're jumping a decade. No film is in the same decade.
Yeah. Yeah, we split it up a little bit there.
My goal was to just not be in the same time frame at all.
Yeah, yeah, you jump forward a lot. We skip over some stuff in the middle there, but
I wouldn't have necessarily went new. I probably would have went with some of my favorites from the French New Wave. But when you said French, I thought of easily 30 films, and most of them were from the 60s, I would say. But one of my favorite ones is Weekend, Godard's Weekend, which is an interesting one. And that was on the top of my mind. And then I even went through like some of the musicals that Demi did, and I really didn't know. Like, my first pick is 100%. We knew that this was coming for a long time. Like, it's a movie that I watched. I'm like, oh my god, that movie's so good. Yeah. It just gets you. And my follow up, the final one, will end up being something that I haven't watched since it came out. And yeah, I think that'll be different. I haven't seen your second pick at all. Yeah. So that'll be new to me.
Yeah, we got some good stuff coming. Next episode, we're jumping forward a little bit to
about 10 years or something. Yeah,
to another director that again, I kind of had a lot of films that I went back and forth with which one I would want to pick. It's Louis Malle, who again has a ton of films on the Criterion Collection. Like
probably all
most
of
yeah most of his major ones at least are on there. He has a lot of good ones, but the one that always sticks with me is The Fire Within that we'll be talking about next week. We mentioned Wes Anderson. I feel like when you watch this, there's some definite moments that you're gonna, there's actually parts that are lifted word for word into Wes Anderson's films from this movie. So you're definitely going to get, this is the most, this film is definitely the most Wes Anderson of all the French films we'll be talking about this month.
Like, so when I was talking about it earlier, you thought, this guy, he doesn't even know.
Yeah, you don't.
He doesn't know what he's getting into.
You don't even know what you're going to get into. Yeah, like I said, there's parts where you're going to be like, oh, that's 100% from like Tannenbaum's or, you know, Darjeeling Limited. Like, there's definitely moments in there that you're like, oh, this is a Wes Anderson character, 100%.
I did look, and at the time, it is on the Criterion Channel, so
there you go. Yeah,
I didn't have to go hunting for it.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah, of course, it's like the one thing I don't own.
Yeah, I don't own your third pick. Well, the third pick overall, your first one. I don't own that one. I never got around to buying it. I watched it when you showed it to me, and then I just never got around to buying it.
That's why.
I know, that's how it always is. If you show me something, I'll just be like, I saw it at Justin's. I'll wait on buying that. I'll buy something that I haven't seen
yet. Yeah, it's harder to jump on something that you just watched, too. Yeah. Like, same thing goes with theatrical, the home video. If it's such a close thing, I'm like, might as well just wait for it to come out. Then I know I'm guaranteed to watch the copy that I just purchased.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
Instead of seeing something and then buying it, then it just sits there.
That's what happens all the time, yeah. But yeah, I think, like I said, I guess if I'm giving any final thoughts, I would say, definitely watch Wages of Fear. His best movies are the two that, again, like you said, the two that you've seen, the Wages of Fear and Le Diabolique, which
I would do the double feature with either Le Diabolique. I don't know how you say it. Diabolique.
Yeah. However, yeah, I
would know. Either do his two movies there, or I would do this with Sorcerer.
Yeah, that well, that's what I did. I watched La Diabolique last night, and then I watched Wages of Fear this morning. That was the double feature that I went with, and interestingly, to cap it all off, since we didn't talk about Diabolique, but one of the
right.
It's weird that Clouseau got compared to Hitchcock a lot, and I mean, Diabolique is somewhat of a Hitchcockian type thriller in certain aspects, but not. I feel like it's overblown, the comparisons, and I feel like they only get compared because of a very specific set of circumstances, which was that I guess Hitchcock wanted to make La Diabolique. He read the book and was interested in it, but Clouseau bought the rights before he could do it, so he missed out on it. And then
maybe that's why he was so hated by his French peers.
People said that too. They said they loved Hitchcock so much, and they said maybe they just felt like he was a poor imitator or something like that. I did hear people say that. Think about your favorite
filmmaker, and they're picking up a book that you want, and then it's like, Yule Bull, he got it. Yeah. You're like, what?
But then it was in a good twist, Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho, said that the reason he wanted to write Psycho was because he watched La Diabolique, and he said it was his favorite movie. So it's like a weird twist of, like, you know, Clouseau takes a film that Hitchcock, I guess, had been looking at. He makes his film, and then Robert Bloch watches that film, and that inspires him to write Psycho, which was obviously a huge, you know, Hitchcock's biggest film that he went out and got. So there's an interesting, like, connection that the two of them have there.
We're going to have to discuss that sometime. I'm actually surprised we didn't.
What, Psycho?
We never did Psycho, did we?
No.
We did Peeping Tom.
Maybe, you know, maybe we'll continue. We brought it up in our last episode, or not the last episode. We brought it up in our Her episode. You know, we need to get into some more just directors. Just really, really look into some more just you know, filmographies of a particular person. So, you know, I feel like we've been holding off on doing Hitchcock, but I feel like we'll get to it here pretty soon. I'm definitely.
Yeah,
I did my marathon last year of all you know, 50 of his films that you can watch and rank that list. So I'm definitely interested in getting in and actually talking about.
We never did any, did we? We haven't done a single one.
I haven't talked about any of his movies.
I mean, when we pick themes and stuff, like, he can't be doing French. He can't be in the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Yeah, we never really did like mystery or thriller, really. The closest we got was like we've done.
You just picked the thriller music video.
Yeah. The closest we've done like some neo noirs and noirs, like you're kind of getting close to his time.
That was
period.
The best decision I think we made in a while, where we were going to do noir and I said let's split it up.
Yeah.
Let's do classic and neo, or else James is going to pick nothing but neo noir, and he was like, damn it, I was going to pick nothing but neo-noir. And we were like, we knew it. We
figured out the way to stop him.
Hey, but then we got things like Asphalt Jungle, and that went over really well with everybody. I always get nervous. That's one of the ones where I'm like, genuinely surprised everybody enjoyed it. I'm like, I love this movie. What'd you guys think? You're like, it was the most okay movie I've ever seen.
It happens sometimes.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to it. We have a pretty good lineup. I'm interested to see if next month even works out, since it's like her second attempt at it. But watch it not. Maybe we just continue. We do it anyways. We'll do see. What we can do. We do what we can do. That's our motto.
Yeah.
We do what we can do. But yeah, we're Cinema Demore. Thank you for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at Cinema Demore. I'm at JJMorgan19. That's where I tell you what I'm watching. And it's usually a spoiler, because I'm like, hey, guess what? I'm watching The Wages of Fear. And you're like, huh, that's interesting, Justin, because you were watching Arrival last time, and and that's what you did last week. Yeah. Occasionally, I won't say what we're doing. I won't tell people what I'm watching to keep the mystery alive. You know, just you got to keep that mystery alive.
Let it be a surprise.
Chuck, you're on Twitter. You don't do anything there yet, nope. But
Chuck Finn 66. Maybe one day.
He did do it. it'll still be there. I think he did his like top 10 directors once. So if you're ever curious,
one time,
I think that's his last tweet.
I think so.
Or Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. Oh, yeah, that's something that, from that.
Yeah, that was the last film I watched and put on Twitter.
Yeah, so that's Chuck on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook too. That's where we do our ads. We already told you what we're gonna watch next week, but sometimes we're sneaky, and that's where we're at. Like the Suicide Squad, absolutely no hinting, just boom, we talked about it. But yeah, we appreciate you guys listening. It means the world to us. Thank you.
Thanks.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.